Yeah, we've moved on rapidly from the Angel to Heathrow Terminal 5. That's one of those venues where you're not quite sure which emotions to bring with you, isn't it? You head there for the flight to some wonderful Pacific Island holiday, and Terminal 5 is the first step to paradise. Or, yeah, the baggage handling goes wrong, the British Airways staff are on strike again, and you find yourself trapped in a 21st century hell on earth, days in the airport departure lounge with the kids. Terminal 5, heaven or hell? You remember the patient in ER? I want a real chaplain who believes in a real God and a real hell. Well, as like him, we wonder this morning, what happens when I die? Let's look at the real God of the Bible. We will find a real hell, but we'll also find he won't stop there. So take up a Bible, would you, and turn to pretty much the last page, to the book of Revelation, page 1249, as Renee comes to read for us from chapter 20.
Then I saw a great white throne and him who was seated on it. Earth and sky fled from his presence, and there was no place for them. And then I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life. The dead were judged according to what they had done, as recorded in the books. The sea gave up the dead that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them. And each person was judged according to what he had done. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. The lake of fire is the second death. If anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, or mourning, or crying, or pain, for the old order of things has passed away." He who was seated on the throne said, "I am making everything new." Then he said, "Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true."
Look, we wince at talk of hell. At least it's worrying if we don't. But we do also at the same time feel the need for it, don't we? Our sense of justice and outrage can demand it. We can speak of it. We even use it in headlines. You see, "So Damned to Hell" was obvious enough. "Mother of Pure Evil," that was Shannon Matthews, who conspired in the abduction of her own daughter. "I hope my daughter rots in hell." That's referring to the brutal killing of baby P. We understand the emotions. We'd be horrified at the idea of a God who would smilingly welcome such people into his heaven as if he was just turning a blind eye to all the evil they'd done. What kind of God would that be? But we're rightly wary as well, aren't we, about the selectivity of this newspaper justice. So as we turn from tabloids or broadsheets back to the Bible, notice this in the passage we've just looked at. Hell is a just, a fair reality. It's a graphic picture of hell. It's the final inescapable prison in which all evil, all rebellion against God can be confined, so it can never exert its poisonous influence again. But did you notice the books? I mean, it was hard to miss them, wasn't it? Look there in verse 12. I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne, and books were opened. Another book was opened, which is the book of life, but the dead were judged according to what they'd done as recorded in the books. My life story written up in the book. It's not judgment by tabloid editor, it's judgment by full and complete disclosure. But it's fair. See, there are no exceptions here. It's not restricted to the media cases. Did you notice that both great and small were involved? Robert Mugabe won't escape this judgment. Yeah, neither will his victims, whose names few of us know. You see in verse 13, the sea gave up the dead and all that were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead that were in them, and each person was judged according to what he'd done. You see, I can reach the grave unscathed, but it doesn't mean I've got away with it. Elsewhere, the Bible speaks of all being judged. It's universal, but also each one, it's individual. I can't hide behind family or tribe or nation. Each person was judged. No exceptions, no omissions, according to what they'd done. And the Bible is clear in 1 Corinthians 4 that God will bring to light what is hidden in darkness. So it includes motives as well as actions. That deed, which looked so awful, but really was well-intentioned, just clumsy and ignorant. The books will make that clear. And that charming action, which in fact was sly and smarmy and manipulative, now, they'll be fully recorded. No exceptions, no omissions, no complaints. Nearly every time the New Testament speaks of God's judgment, it speaks of him judging justly or judging righteously. And when the verdict comes, we're told in Romans 3, every mouth will be silenced. There'll be no complaints, no appeals. We'll nod our heads in agreement. We'll put our hand up and say, that's fair. That's right. Hey, I discover, of course, as I look at this, it's one thing to make all these statements as a sort of dispassionate Bible student, but I'm no exception myself. Now, I won't find anything I say will be omitted. I won't be able to complain. And I know that there's only one verdict when all my words and deeds and thoughts are there opened up in the book. And then I've got to face the language of what hell's like. The lake of fire, the second death. You can't just call that disturbing. And I know that the one who speaks most and most vividly about hell is Jesus. And his language may be picture language. Gehenna, the town rubbish dump where the fires are always burning, gnashing of teeth, outer and utter darkness. But none of them are pictures I want to experience. They're intended to be disturbing. Well, the language may all be metaphorical, but hell isn't a metaphor, it's a reality and a real destination. If I'm asking, what happens when I die? It was the writer and scholar C.S. Lewis who once saw a gravestone with this inscription: "Here lies an atheist, all dressed up, but with nowhere to go." And as he turned away, Lewis commented, "I bet he wishes that were so." And alongside all of this, the Bible lays another book. You spotted it there in verse 12, didn't you? Another book was opened, the book of life. Another book and another destination. Not just hell, a just reality, but heaven, a radical reality. Oh, some may nod at the concept of heaven, but will you look more closely? Match this against the blandness, the limpness of so many other people's hopes. I love Nick Hornby, the novelist. He's a very clever writer. His book Fever Pitch is full of humor and the passion of the fanatical football fan. You can forgive him that it's Arsenal he supports. But is this idea he speaks of in the book really substance enough for eternity? "I was one of those," he wrote, "who would be happy to have my ashes scattered over the Highbury pitch. It would be nice to think I could hang around the stadium in some form and watch the first team one Saturday, the reserves the next. It doesn't seem a bad way to spend eternity. I want to float around Highbury as a ghost, watching reserve games for the rest of time. Now, you may have a few questions about that way to spend the rest of time. Nick Hornby's probably quite grateful he's still alive because he knows now that Arsenal have switched and play at the Emirates and not Highbury, but there are deeper problems than that. But too many of us in Christian circles haven't really got beyond our equivalent. When heaven comes into our mind, we still think in unexcitingly vacuous pictures of harps and clouds and white togas. So look at what the Bible actually says. Look at chapter 1 and verse 1. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. This is something far more tangible and real, a new cosmos, a new creation. The language used in these last couple of chapters describes it in terms of a city. You can't get much more concrete than that. Or a garden with a river and trees and fruits. You can't get much more earthy than that. Or verse 3. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Now the dwelling of God is with men, and he will live with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God." Right at the heart of this new world is God. He's the creator, he's the Lord, he's the center. A radio program once asked a number of famous people what they thought heaven would be like. And all of the answers had these points in common. Everyone believed in heaven. Everyone assumed they would be there. No one mentioned that God was there. But he's the heart of it. I mean, if I have no interest in God now, why on earth would I have an interest in heaven? Verse 4. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There'll be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Well, it has to have done, because you can't live in this world without tears and death and mourning and crying and pain. And they've no place in the next. It's hard to imagine, isn't it, that kind of life. Hard to imagine what kind of changed people we will need to be to live that life. Or verse 5, he who was seated on the throne said, "Behold, I'm making everything new." I mean, it's so positive. I don't know if we realize just how positive it is. You've only got to compare it with other people's attempts. Here is Philip Pullman, the novelist. His trilogy, his Dark Materials, it's on many a GCSE reading list. Great story writing, aggressively atheist in content. And at the end, he pictures the souls of the dead from way back over the centuries, all being released, excited. And what are they looking forward to? Real life back on Earth? Any kind of real personal existence? Not at all. The greatest thing they're all longing for, and which happens as they joyfully and excitedly escape from the ghostly life of souls, is extinction. They dissolve back into the elements of the universe. Listen, as Pullman writes, "Will enlarge the window as wide as he could, making it big enough for 6, 7, 8 to walk through abreast out of the land of the dead. The first ghosts trembled with hope, and their excitement passed back like a ripple over the long line behind them, young children and aged parents alike, looking up and ahead with delight and wonder as the first stars they'd seen for centuries shone through into their poor, starved eyes. The first ghost to leave the world of the dead was Roger. He took a step forward and turned to look back at Lyra and laughed in surprise as he found himself turning into the night, the starlight, the air, and then he was gone, leaving behind such a vivid little burst of happiness that Will was reminded of the bubbles in a glass of champagne." And Chris Wright, in his book, The God I Don't Understand, wrote this. I read that and I think, is that it? Is that the best the atheist imagination can offer? Death as the popping cork of a champagne bottle, a little bursting bubble of happiness, and then nothing. Nothing personal. Nothing gloriously human, just dissolution into the everything of the rest of the universe. Well, look back at verse 5. Look, take confidence that he who was seated on the throne, he who is really in control, he said, I am making everything new. Not some superficial makeover, not a fresh coat of paint, but a new creation to explore, a new body to live in, a new work for us to do, new joy to experience, new character to be at home there. Write this down, he added, for these words are trustworthy and true. He's not just saying the Bible has got to can do better than the imagination of the secularist or the pygmy Christian. And it isn't even just take God's word for it, though I can. And he's left traces that he's trustworthy scattered across history. Supremely through the resurrection of Jesus it's solid, reliable history. It's check it out history that there is a life beyond this one. Evidence that's listed in the Bible and gathered together in numerous books, including the ones we mentioned you can find downstairs. What happens after death? The Bible points to two destinations. A hell that's worse than we think. You know how sometimes bitterly we say hell's too good for him? Or frivolously, we say, well, at least my mates will be there. We haven't understood how terrible it'll be. How terrible we will be. Without any traces of God and his goodness, when they're all removed from our environment and our characters. Now, hell is worse than we think. And the other destination, it's a heaven that's better than we imagine.